bring the Agriculture, Environment, Natural Resources, Finance Committee to order. And we have a quorum. And first order of business will be to approve the minutes of March 10th. Representative Pennis?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have even asked about them, and I approve.
Okay, Representative Pennis approves. I don't see the rest of us will. The minutes are before us. Any corrections or additions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Pennis wins.
No.
There's something
over
here every day.
We are going to start this morning first with a couple of quick bills so that we can, and then we'll go to some public testimony with regard to DNR's presentation. But first I'd like to bring up Representative Ida Gerken. House File 796. Representative Heidgerger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 796.
Okay, we'll move that for you.
And I have just a small little oral amendment if you pick it. The bill's not to... Brevity is, I understand that the legislature here is far more effective than some of the long bills, but this is a very short, simple bill. The line 10 should read, for clarification, Alternative Swine Task Force and Programs and for Development of Alternative Dairy and Other Livestock Programs. It would make more sense if those two words were included, Mr. Chair.
So it'd be after force, we would insert?
And programs and for development. And I think Rebecca has that, as does Marilyn. I gave that earlier to them.
Okay, to get the bill in the order that the author chooses, I move that amendment. Any questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Prevails. The bill is amended. And Representative Hoppy loses on that one. So. Let's see, the keeping score today. Welcome to the committee, and if you please... explain the bill.
Okay, thank you. I will start with the bill itself. I was asked to do this bill. I have 26 little organic farms, sustainable farmers, just in Stearns County, and I have a couple out in Polk County. I've been here to testify, Mary Jo Forberg and Ali Lancott down in Candy, Ohio. So I have quite a few of these little farmers that are operating in this fashion. And it's kind of the environmentally sound way of farming. They have a lot of pastures, Chair, and they have a lot of pulpa fields, and it's a throwback to the old way of farming. And we're having more and more farmers in my district are looking at this as an alternative. Some of them are milking 100 cows. I know a couple of them that asked me about this program. They would like to cut back down to 25 and 30 and go into the organic niche. Within my district, I also have a creamery over at Sauk Center, the old Sauk Center Co-op Creamery, that now exclusively deals with bottled organic milk, and they have a market for it. So with that said, I'm going to be very brief. I'll introduce Helene or Paul, whichever one wants to go first, and introduce your name, and I think the chair will take some testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Sopczynski. I work for the Land Future Project. The Land Future Project is a farm and rural organization that works with promote sustainable agriculture. Appreciate the opportunity to say a few words in support of Representative Heidgerken's bill. We look at this bill as an opportunity to take a program that's been successful at the University of Minnesota in terms of dealing with alternative swine. That is kind of my background. I happen to also be a hog producer. As a hog producer, I've seen how the program has provided benefits to my operations, but also to our members' operations. For example, in terms of the alternative swine program, one of the things that we went through was through a real farm depression back in 1998 when hogs went down to $8, worse than that is depression of the 1930s. And having this program on board and working with farmers looking at different opportunities in terms of markets that they might reach that would improve their bottom line choices. And that's one of the things, for example, I'm now a producer with Nyman Ranch. I've been for the last 2 years. It's a special market. It is an itch market. It's a market that's antibiotic-free, that consumers are now more identifying with. We grew from, in 1998, from about 20 producers to about 500 producers today. And it's a growing market today for independent folks to compete. Our particular market has a floor price, but also has an open top. Our floor price is roughly around in the $40 range. So that's substantially better than what the price went down back in 1998 to. So that's the same opportunity we see now in terms of looking at livestock in this state. We're looking at a shortage of the number of dairy operations, dairy cows, and cattle. We see that same opportunity to expand this program to also include other livestock, in particular dairy. And the program we think works well in terms of reaching outreach to bring farmers together from different backgrounds and some of the dialogue discussion types of seats that the coordinator arranges in terms of out-state meetings. So with that, I just want to say I fully support this. I also want to say that this key for this request is outside the university request, in addition to University of Minnesota, in my opinion, has done a good job in terms of a number of the agricultural programs, and we support and follow the package that the university brings forth. This request is in addition to that. And this particular request allows the opportunity for those who are looking at sustainable agriculture to work within the university system. And we've developed a partnership within the university. A number of our farmers before felt they weren't included, and now this has kind of bridged that gap of how, for example, to work within the university in terms of research and other needs that our farmers have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, sir. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank Representative Heidjergen for bringing this bill forward. Mr. Sobosinski, for the benefit of the committee, would you just define organic and sustainable agriculture?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heidjergen, sustainable agriculture is the term which farmers look at, or the way I describe it, look in terms of how their operations sustain, first of all, the farmer, then the community, and the environment. So we try to look at, in terms of our operations, how to move in that type of direction. And maybe I can provide more the example. And I don't have a perfect definition. For example, one of the pieces that we've been supporting is the conservation security program on the federal level that rewards farmers for the stewardship that they do on their farms. In terms of how it, for example, can improve water quality, through grazing, having more grasses and perennials on the land. So, sustainable agriculture involves the farmer and looking at his farm as a total picture within the ecosystem and within the community. That's how I define sustainable agriculture. And thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rudolph, let me pause. Does Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either any one of you today, what types of projects or what sorts of programs do you expect to fund if this money is received? And do you have a preference within this task force supporting changing over to alternatives or helping people get started in alternatives? And I'm just wondering, just for the conversation around agriculture, at what point does the word alternative drop off with this type of valid production? I think that labeling these types of activities as alternatives when there's valid and growing markets across the United States, it does a disservice to this sector of agriculture. So I would appreciate at some point formalize and not pigeonhole these types of activities as alternative or sustainable or somehow not in form with modern agriculture. So that's just more of a comment. But I'm wondering who you're going to fund exactly.
Let's have Ms. Murray from University of Minnesota provide her testimony. Maybe she'll answer that question in that during that testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Heather Murray, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, commonly known as NISA. NISA is a unique partnership between the College of Agricultural, Food, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Minnesota and a group collectively known as the Sustainers Coalition, a group of individuals and nonprofit organizations. NISA brings together the diverse interests of the agricultural community and the interests from across the university in a cooperative effort to develop and promote sustainable agriculture in Minnesota and beyond. Minnesota is a diverse state, and the University of Minnesota provides research and education and outreach programs that farmers of many different types and sizes need. The alternative swine and dairy programs are located at the West Central Research and Outreach Center in Morris. These are complement to the more traditional livestock programs that we have at the other research and outreach centers. The University of Minnesota is a national leader in sustainable agriculture. The Elwell Ecology Farm at Lamberton at the Southwest Research and Outreach Center has more certified organic acreage than any other land-grant university in the country. This work is nationally recognized. It is of special interest to the subject we're discussing today because the land for the feed of our alternative swine and dairy programs comes from Lamberton. In 1997, the legislature provided funding to the Alternative Swine Production Systems Task Force. The program is located at the West Central Research and Outreach Center in Morris and conducts research on the following programming: hoop houses and alternative housing options, pasture farrowing and finishing, and a Swedish sheep-style deep-bedded farrowing system and group nursery systems are in place. We also conduct many educational and outreach activities, including farmer roundtable discussion groups, workshops, field days, a website, newsletter, and a listserv. The work of the Alternative Swine Program is nationally and internationally recognized for its excellent research and outreach program. The dairy program at the West Central Research and Outreach Center is designed to serve the needs of moderate-sized dairy farms with a focus on the role of grazing in sustainable systems and the evaluation of forages for lactating dairy cows. The Research and Outreach Center is conducting a 5-year study comparing conventional dairy management with a reduced investment dairy production system focused on spring calving dairy production, intensive grazing for feed, and crossbred genetics for hardy cattle and for outdoor bedded packs for housing. They're also exploring what it would take to convert some of the dairy herd at the station to certified organic that would enable them to do the comparisons between certified organic and non. At the University of Minnesota, we take very seriously our role as a source of new ideas, new knowledge, and information. The Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture and the Alternative Swine and Dairy Program is part of that effort to help position and prepare Minnesota for the future. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Kenyon.
Yes, thank you. Do you all engage in helping folks market?
We engage... members of the committee, Representative Chair, we engage in discussion groups to help farmers figure out how they're going to market. We're not specifically out marketing for them.
The reason I asked this, I was struck, and this is a 10-year-old fact, but I was struck, there was an article in the New York Times in the food section talking about folks who were growing sheep in Pennsylvania and marketing into the lucrative New York restaurant market, and they were selling premium lamb chops for, I imagine they were organic, for $72 a dozen. And that was 10 years ago. And here we have this huge market of Chicago, which is equally close to us, and I've always wondered why we couldn't tap more into that market.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benias, can I respond?
Yes.
As the question you raised, that one of the pieces that the program does, for example, offer right now in swine, and that's the very reason we want to expand it to other livestock species, is to kind of bridge that marketing information to include other species. For example, in terms of alternative hog markets, if I might give a couple examples, a number of our producers for example, Jim Vanderpool from the Murdoch Charter City area is a direct marketer. He also happens to be a Nyman Ranch producer. And some folks who are looking at these kinds of markets, some people like direct marketing. Like my operation, I don't happen to, that's not the approach that happens to fit me. And so, for example, through the program that we have right now at the university in terms of alternative swine programs, how I became aware of Nyman Ranch. So what the university has done with this program is made these various alternatives in terms of information available for farmers to make choices around. So the type of market you're talking about with lamb is the kind of information that would, you know, for example, be provided. People have to make their own choices about where they go. The university is not going to recommend a specific market, but rather provide the information and share what, you know, what some of the protocols that some of those markets might require. For example, within my particular market in terms of Nyman Ranch, it's part of the antibiotic free, and we have certain rules, we have certain types of seeds that we feed, we have to follow. So it's that kind of information that would be available through this program.
Rip Sanjaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. One of the trends, I guess, we're seeing over at the university nowadays is like when we give money to researchers, the university is charging 25%, 30%, 40% overhead costs to them. Can we be assured that this money, $200,000, will go all to the Institute for Sustainable Agriculture for use by them to put programs onto the ground, or is the university administration going to swoop in and say, well, you know, you're using our buildings and we've got this cost and this cost, and all of a sudden 40% of it is gone and you're left with much less?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the university will not charge the overhead on those funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. House File 796 is laid over, or as amended, is laid over for possible insertion in the omnibus.
Thank you, members. Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We now have Representative Blaine, House File 824. I'll move House File 824. Senator Blaine.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Committee, the House File 824 is the Forest Assistance Account Bill. This is a bill that is supported by the Department of Natural Resources, brought to me by the department. I have Bob Tomlinson here with me today at the table, too, to help answer any questions with this. Mr. Chair, as members probably see, the bill is not real lengthy, but it can be maybe slightly confusing. So if, with your permission, I'd just like to go through some talking points that are pertinent to this bill, and then I would be more than happy to dissect the bill if need be, or certainly answer any questions.
Yeah, proceed.
Thank you. Many of you probably know that in 2004 the legislature established a dedicated account within the Natural Resources Fund called the Forest Management Investment Account. Department of Natural Resources supported the creation of the Forest Management Investment Account because it did three things. It provides some minimal level of stability and reliability in funding for basic forest management practices. It works to better diversify forest management program funding with the creation of the Forest Management Investment Account. It reduced the DNR Forestry's Department's dependence on general fund funding from 99% to 82%. And it also provides an ability to carry fund balances between bienniums. This is important because the timber management and timber sales is a seasonal business. Money appropriated to the DNR from the Forest Management Investment Account can be used for the following purposes: reforestation and timber stand improvement, including forest pest management, timber sales and commercial thinning contracts and sales, and state forest road maintenance. Right now, timber sale receipts from forestry-acquired lands and about half of the timber sale receipts from the forestry-administered ConCon lands are deposited in the Forest Management Investment Account. This is about $6.2 million annually. Of the $6.2 appropriation to the DNR from the Forest Management Investment Account, about half is spent on management of state forest trust lands. But although that this is happening, the Forest Management Investment Account does not receive any timber sale receipts that are generated by the management of these trust fund lands. So you can probably see the Forest Management Investment Account is supporting the investments and returns on the trust funds lands without any reimbursement for the cost that this account is incurring. And the reason we're here is over time this weakens the integrity or the corpus of the Forest Management Investment Account. What House File 824 does is would return a portion of the certified state forest trust land management costs, and these are costs that are consistent with the purposes of the Forest Management Investment Account to that account rather than to the state general fund. This proposal is general fund neutral. This does not reduce the amount of money that's going to the general fund, and it does so in the fact that the DNR general fund appropriation will be reduced by the same amount that the general fund revenues are reduced. If this bill passes, the bill would reduce the DNR forestry's dependence on general fund direct appropriations to about 70%, with 30% coming from the Forest Management Investment Account. That way the corpus of the trust funds will not be affected. So in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman and members, that is what we're up to.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you, Chair Usman. This question is to Mr. Tomlinson. Is there, pardon my lack of institutional knowledge on this subject, but has there ever been a time that the legislature hasn't appropriated the actual costs that you incurred managing the trust lands back to forestry from the general fund? That you certify the costs, as I understand it. And it's known what the costs are, and it always has been known it when you certify it. But has there ever been a time that you were shortchanged on that amount to recoup your money?
Mr. Chair, Bob Tomlinson, Assistant Director with the DNR Division of Forestry. Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, members of the committee, there was a time back in the 90s, in the 80s, and I think up until the early 90s, when much of the timber revenue was dedicated back through what they at that time, I believe, called Forest Management Account. And those dollars, that account went away in the early 90s as a part of a larger state government effort to have less dedicated accounts and more reliance on the general fund appropriation as a way to fund the agencies, by the way. I think your question, so that's part of my answer. I guess the other part is I can't say that, well, let me just say that our general fund appropriations have been reduced over the last several biennials, either directly reduced or as a result of inflation and not covering increases or those sorts of things like that. We haven't been able to keep up with the appropriations in a large regard. With the work, our whole time equivalents are less now than they were 4 or 5 years ago, considerably less, and that's due to a number of factors, which you're probably aware of.
Thank you, Chair Osmond. So, when you receive the money now, you will be able to enhance your ability to put up more wood as appropriate, and where allowable, where we have the resources to harvest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bill, we feel that it's more certain that we will be able to do that in the future with the dedicated account rather than as high a level of reliance on the general fund as we have had over the past several years. We think that's one of the benefits of this. The other thing that Representative Blaine mentioned as well is that the seasonality of this work. We have tree planting contracts, for example, probably totaling up to maybe $1 million or more for this coming spring. And if that work doesn't get done this spring because it's too wet to get out in the fields with tree planting machines and those sorts of things like that, then the work's not done, but the money doesn't roll forward into the next biennium. With it in the dedicated fund and coming out of that, that provides for that level of management across the biennial lines, which will enable us then to better manage those types of situations, if you will, with our workloads. It could be contracts for tree planting or road work or other things like that.
Ms. Thomason, underneath the current law, you are limited in your management capabilities based upon the amount of money that's appropriated out of the general fund? Is that how this works under current law?
That's correct. Okay. And out of the forest management investment, the existing forest management investment account.
And out of, or in this change, what we do is there would not be a specified amount from the legislature with regard to management. You'd just be able to take out of the account what you need in order to provide management?
No, Mr.
This is still in the accounting process or budgeting process.
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding is that we would, just as any other dedicated account, we would be back here on a biennial basis looking for an appropriation from the legislature out of the forest management investment. So
this is not a statutory appropriation?
That would be correct.
You'll wait till next year to bring that in, I assume.
We don't intend to try it. Our intention, when we put this in place last year, we said there were basically three types of land that timber is harvesting occurs on: the Tonton acres, the acquired lands, and the trust fund lands. And last year we dealt with the Tonton lands. 50% of the revenues off of those come into the forest management investment account. The other 50% go back to the counties. All of the revenues off the acquired lands currently come to us as per last year's legislation. We basically look at this as the third and final leg, if you will, of the three-legged stool relative to the forest management investment account. The money's coming in off the trust fund lands. Only that part of it that are the certified costs against the trust fund that would otherwise go back to the general fund would come back to this instead of that. It would be a budget neutral, but you wouldn't be giving up any oversight, is our understanding the way it works, with your legislative oversight relative to how we spend the money and otherwise. It's pretty specific on how we spend it right now in the statute.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Joe.
I think, Mr. Chair, I got this. I got a handle on this, I think. So I'm going to ask one more question. The 20%, is just a flat, straight-out amount that comes off the top then of the revenues, as I understand it. So what happens when your expenses are less than 20%, you actually are cutting into the amount that would go to the schools. Would that be a correct assumption?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I'm not sure where the 20% comes from, but the certified cost is the actual amount that we spend on school trust fund management activities right now, to include things like putting up timber for sale, reforestation efforts, forest land improvement efforts, those sorts of things. We keep very close track of how much time and money we spend on those activities by the different land types that we're spending it on. And thus we put together the certification of the cost that would go back to the general fund.
So, last question. The net effect, Mr. Chairman, the net effect then is that it won't cost any more or any less to the trust fund for the purpose that it was intended. It just that it will redirect the money back into the forest management account so that you can have more of an assurance that you're going to have it.
That's correct. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Representative Bill.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, House File 824 is laid open for possible inclusion in the Environmental Trust or Environmental Natural Resource Omnibus Bill. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. We will now go to public testimony with regard to the Department of Natural Resources budget presentation, which concluded the other day. And first on the agenda is Judy Erickson. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the Parks and Trails Council. And with me today is Jeff Olson, Marcia Hillestead, and Terry Fierro. And we do appreciate the opportunity to be here, and we thank you and the committee for taking the time to take public testimony on the DNR's budget. First of all, I want to recognize the hard work that the department has put into their budget. It has been a number of years that have been challenging for all of us, and DNR general fund budgets have been reduced by $31.3 million since FY01, with an additional $6 million in this year's budget. So they have worked very hard in crafting their budget, and I just want to acknowledge the work that they have done. And we want to also acknowledge and extend our appreciation to the governor for not proposing any general fund budget reductions for state parks and trails. We do remain concerned with the general direction that state parks and trail budgets have been in the last several years, which has been in decline. And the consequence that we are concerned about is a decline in visitor satisfaction and a negative impact on our tourism economy. A few quick comments on the governor's budget. And you have a couple of handouts in your packets. First of all, again, there were no general fund budget reductions proposed for state parks and trails. Lottery and loo funding is increased according to increases in lottery and loo revenues. Visitor services, seasonal naturalists, and routine maintenance is not restored. Trail funding will not keep pace with the demand for new trail mileage, and additional service reductions in 2007 are likely as a result of inflation. We are generally very supportive of the direction that Cortland Nelson and Lori Martinson, the two division directors, are taking in their work at the department. We recognize that they have some significant challenges in maintaining their systems with less and less revenue to do it. And we know that they are looking at additional service reductions in FY07 that will impact our state parks, our trails, and the communities around Minnesota. And we hope that as you move forward, you know, there was some question and discussion at the time of the budget presentation of what those impacts might be. But we hope that as we move forward, we can have some additional discussion on what those would look like. And we'd be happy, of course, to work with the committee on those. We can hear from the rest of the panel before we take a public question.
Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Olson, Chair of the Legislative Committee, and President of Parks and Trails Council for 2 years up until a year ago. It's a great day. It's a great day any time you have a chance to talk about Parks and Trails of Minnesota. The treasures of the state of Minnesota, crown jewels, as the author said, everyone's country estate, everyone's lake place, everyone's cabin, everyone's waterfall, from Great Bluffs in the southeast corner of Lake Bronson, northwest, Pigeon River, highest waterfall at Grand Portage, down to the Buffalo Blue Mounds. And as president, just as you in your district, I would get the calls from the users, the visitors, the hikers, the campers, of the visitor center being locked, of the cross-country skis trails not being open, not being groomed, of the naturalists not being around. So over the last couple of years, we've gotten more and more concerned about the direction of our state parks and trails they're taking. I should mention Parks and Trails Council has 2,500 members, and what we say 7,000 affiliate membership, because the number of our members are organizations. Met Representative Junkie last June at Sibley State Park. They have a very active association. For instance, I think they're close to 7,500 members. We have other friends groups that are 50 members. Glendale State Park at Battle Lake is a fairly active 150. We have organizations such as Superior Hiking Trail Association has 3,000 members statewide. That gets us up to that 7,000 number. But I echo Judy's comments about appreciation to the governor for recognizing the role and the value of state parks and trails and the role that they play in Minnesota. But simply holding the line is not enough to keep the parks and trails adequately maintained and open for use. Now, we don't have these dramatic campground or park closures that we had 4 or 5 years ago, but instead it's been replaced by a system of cutting or eliminating services. Services of program staff, visitor center, contact station hours. So the average park user doesn't see it immediately, but as they come for their weekend, their four-day weekend, their once-a-week campground visit. For instance, there are no seasonal naturalists left in the state park system. Visitor centers such as Blue Mounds, Lake Bronson, St. Clair State Park are closed year-round. Visitor centers aren't open daily. Security and park patrols are cut back. Spring and fall camping in 15 state parks has been eliminated. Cross-country ski trails aren't groomed on a regular basis or are closed. And there's a lot of concerns about delayed maintenance of buildings, limited resource management, and how that affects the parks. I have two stories to tell. One is John Philippi. I don't know if anybody's ever had the pleasure. I hope all of you live a long life, but I hope the rest of your life you get a chance to take that Bog Rock Tour. John Philippi is the permanent full-time naturalist at Lake Bemidji State Park. It takes about 45 minutes, an hour. You go through the bog, see all the orchids, the acid, fantastic resource treasure state of Minnesota, Philippi. Brings up 2 points. One, we've had 2 summers in which there's been no seasonal naturalists. What that means with some of the cuts in permit, we're down to about 12 full-time naturalists. That means out of 66 state parks, approximately 56 do not have any naturalists at any time. And I highlight John because he's permanent, but we're losing. For instance, Hennepin County Suburban Parks, the Three Rivers Park District, has the same number of full-time naturalists for park preserves of 16 out of their 26 sites, and they have part-time or seasonal. But second, I highlight Lake Bemidji. Great story there. Overall state parks, 3 or 4 years ago, we had the highest number of visitors at 8.6 million visitors within a year. It's ranged about 20%, sometimes as low as 15, but 15 to 20% are out-of-state or out-of-the-country visitors. So it's a great, for instance, use that 8 million figure, 1.5 million are from out-of-state. Lake Bemidji State Park, which sits on the north end of Lake Bemidji, about 8 to 10 miles from the city of Bemidji, they receive every year 10%
from Canada, the campgrounds, and 15% from North Dakota. Now, this is not a state park that's on the border. It's not a state park that's right off the freeway exit. It's 80 miles to the North Dakota border, 140 miles to Canada. And yet you can see the out-state averages is from Canada and North Dakota alone, 35% there. You go to Lake Bronson, which, of course, is much closer to Canada than North Dakota. Those figures go up to 25% from North Dakota, 15% from Canada, and they have an out-of-state of over 50%. The other story is Parks and Trails provides a lot of workshops for friends, groups, trail associations. I remember several years ago we had a workshop, and you talked about improving newsletter membership, working with DNR. And we had Bill Davis, a volunteer at the Great River Bluffs, right in the southeast corner there near La Center, fairly small park, not a large campground, and he acts as an ambassador to the campground. So he volunteers, I think it was two Friday nights, 5 to 10 o'clock, and he had counted just in his volunteer time, 46 states, 6 countries, just in one summer. So it's amazing the out-of-state, and what that's an indication of is the importance of tourism and the economy. So we're concerned about a couple steps away from a ghost town type of situation at a lot of the parks. And this is the quality of life of Minnesota. The regional state trends indicate more demand and revision of future integrated system of parks. We know each of you are facing many challenges as you consider the governor's budget proposal and as you develop your sort of recommendations. We simply ask that you keep in mind the role that state parks play in our economy and how they add to the quality of life of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Hillis-Bad, and I'm an owner of a resort on the north shore of Lake Superior, Cove Point Lodge. I'm also a board member of Parks and Trails. I'm a board member of the Spirit Hiking Trail Association, and I'm also a lifetime member of the Gichigami Bike Trail Association. So as you can see, they're very important to what I think is our way of life in Minnesota. I want to point out a couple of key facts on the relationship between state parks and trails and our tourism economy. Tourism is a $10 billion industry in Minnesota, and it's comparable to agriculture in its contributions to our gross state product. Visiting state parks and trails is one of the top 5 activities for tourists in Minnesota, contributing over $200 million in economic activity. 33% of all Minnesotans visit a state park. Many of the top activities enjoyed by our travelers, enjoying the great outdoors, exploring our natural and cultural heritage, camping, fishing, they're all found in our Minnesota state parks. Cove Point Lodge is on the North Shore. It's located within 10 minutes of 3 of our wonderful state parks in the state, Teteguch State Park, Split Rock, and Gooseberry. And we've always highlighted all of the activities at these state parks on our bulletin board at the lodge. Our families that stay there are always checking things out. Over the past few years, many of the naturalist programs have been eliminated, and there are big holes in the day for a lot of the families that come up north and want to appreciate what we have up there. 2 weeks ago, I was talking to a group of cross-country skiers at the lodge, and they had come up to use the cross-country trails, had gone over to Split Rock, which is their favorite trail right along the water, and it had not been groomed. And here they are up there to vacation, to enjoy our great state, and there are not facilities available to them. I'll just go on. As a business owner, the quality of our state park experiences translates into happy customers, and visitor dissatisfaction means unhappy customers and potentially fewer customers at our resorts. And there are many, many smaller resorts, mom-and-pop places that are suffering a lot more than others. We also finally this year had great weather. We had snow, and all the people flocked up north for the snow, and we did not have facilities for them to enjoy it. So it really does impact the economic situation on the shore. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, ma'am. Chairman Osmond, members of the committee. My name is Terry Furrow. I'm a resident of Goodhue, Minnesota, southeast Minnesota, south of Red Wing, north of Rochester. I've been a resident there since 1971 when I came as a rookie basketball coach and high school teacher. I'm now employed as a comp representative for a Minnesota-based telecommunications equipment distributor, covering small independent telephone companies in the 5 upper Midwest states. So I spent a lot of time in smaller communities, especially in Minnesota. I don't think it's any secret to many of us in greater Minnesota the key role that parks and trails play in the tourism economy. And I'm going to focus on trails and rural impact in particular. The economic benefits of trails are numerous, as I'm sure many of you have considered in the past. Nearly one-third of all Minnesotans ride bike on a regular basis. In most years, amazing to me, the more bikes are sold in this country than automobiles. In 2003, it was 18.5 million bicycles, 17 million cars. Biking is the third most popular vacation activity in the United States. And in Minnesota, it's conservatively estimated that parks and trail visits contribute more than $200 million annually to the state economy. Minnesota leads the nation in the number of miles of paved bikeways, and our partially completed system of 20 operating trails and 8 state authorized trails is the envy of every state in the nation. I'm amazed in my travels throughout rural parts of the Midwest and the number of smaller cities, Iowa in particular, where I see small towns have established small recreational trails. The difference from Minnesota is that these trails are not linked in any kind of a system. And we have in place the start of a really terrific, I would call it an intrastate interstate system. Trails are a proven framework for tourism, rural economic development, and revitalization. One needs to look no further than the Root River and Paul Bunyan trails to find evidence of this very positive economic impact on the associated trail cities. On a personal note, I had a assistant basketball coach who moved to Goodview from Lanesboro prior to the construction of the Root River Trail. It took him over 3 years to try to sell his home in that town. That town was dead, absolutely dead. And, of course, not every town could be Lanesboro, but the economic impact and the focus it gives these small rural communities is truly amazing. Trails enhance property values. Trails spark new diverse business opportunities, especially in rural communities overly dependent on eroding agricultural-based economies. Trails provide desperately needed infrastructure improvements to allow rural communities to retain a larger portion of their youthful populations, which is critical to their future growth. And trails contribute incentives for historical and cultural preservation efforts. In the city of Goodview, for example, 1992, I became involved with a group promoting a Goodview Pioneer Trail that's now in the authorized and beginning construction stages. And out of those discussions came an organization called the Forever Goodview Coalition. Tons of plans, hopes, dreams. With the length of time it's taken our trail to get developed, some of those have fallen by the wayside. But just recently, the Goodview County Agriculture Museum opened in the city of Goodview in cooperation with the County Historical Society to preserve the railroad and the agricultural aspects of our city's history. Additionally, trails contribute greatly to the health and physical well-being of Minnesotans and visitors. Healthcare experts recognize that parks and trails are integral parts of improving the health of our citizens. Parks and trails give individuals and families a safe and inviting place to walk, run, bike, rollerblade, or cross-country ski. And research shows that providing parks and trails will lead to increased physical activity, but corresponding decrease in the level of diseases related to physical inactivity. This is especially significant when it's known that over 40% of the current American population is over the age of 60. In the case of Goodview, we have a city trail that has been constructed in the year 2000 at a cost of about $60,000. The significance of that is that at that time I was on the city council of Goodview and our entire city budget was less than $300,000. So the commitment is there in rural America to look at diversified ways of enhancing their economies as well as providing for the physical well-being of their citizens. And the importance of immediately addressing health issues has been highlighted by recent statistical evidence showing the youth of America testing out increasingly poor levels of fitness. Many rural communities lack the resources and population densities to build formal fitness centers and exercise facilities. Trails then become one of the few venues for physical activity that are affordable, simple, and accessible. And the word safe comes in there as our community, granted, probably was an isolated situation, but about 2.5 years ago, a citizen of our community, during an early morning walk along a county highway, was tragically struck and killed by a young man going to his farm job blinded by the early morning sun as she walked along the shoulder of a county road. So lacking an accessible trail, most people will use existing sidewalks, city streets, and shoulders of county and state highways. Very safe, unsafe alternative. The net effect is many bikes stay in the garage and many walking shoes stay in the front closet. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, general fund support for our state trail system is below 1995 levels. That's in real dollars, not even adjusted for inflation. The loss of general fund support for state trails has not been a tsunami of dramatic overnight budget slashes, but has rather been a slow, quiet, slow erosion of support. If the governor's proposal for maintaining the current general funding levels for parks and trails for the next biennium is not supported, the DNR will face the possibility of further cuts in an already depleted staff. Further cuts in the number of available full-time local DNR trail planners will be devastating to grassroots organizations such as the Goodview Pioneer Trail Association, of which I'm a charter member. These local organizations are the heart and soul of the trail movement in the state. Without the consistent, accessible professional guidance and consultation by DNR's committed trained planners, these fledgling organizations may struggle, become frustrated, and very likely lose the high level of energy and focus needed to stay the long course to promote this wonderful legacy of greenways for this generation as well as generations to come. From another perspective, without adequate supervision and planning, routine trail repair and maintenance activities are lost, which means the trail eventually get repaired only when the trail's conditions worsen enough to qualify for bonding dollars. Additionally, several of the older trails are in need of a facelift to modernize them to present standards of 10-foot wide pathways. From the original 6 and 8-foot widths, it seems efficient in the 70s before rollerbladers with 6-foot wide strides and the heavy uses that we're seeing in trails today. In closing, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, an investment in parks and trails is an investment in our tourism economy, encouraging economic development and revitalization in rural Minnesota, while providing solutions to spiraling costs in health dollars and physical wellness for the long-term decline in American health. While there are many other enhancements I'd love to discuss today, the first priority is to maintain the health or present system by stopping the current bleeding. Your attention to and consideration of this vital issue is greatly appreciated, and I thank you very much for your time. Are there any questions?
Any questions, Representative Wagenius?
Well, thank you for your honest testimony. Refreshing. I think Marcia Hillstaff?
Yes.
I was taken by your comment that mom and pop's resorts are suffering. Could you just elaborate on that just a bit?
We're at the whims of weather. We're at the whims of the economy. We're at the whims of all kinds of things for people spending their vacation dollars wherever they go. And the other things that are causing problems along, especially places along North Shore or a lot of lakefront areas, our property taxes are going up. My property taxes went up 25% this year. That's huge. That's just phenomenal. All the other tax, you know, we're trying to cut taxes in our state government, but you're taxing often enough times the wrong people that can't afford that kind of increases. So on top of that, when the facilities that our customers can go to are being slowly degraded and eroding away, little by little you're really chipping away at a really important part of this economy in our state.
If I could just follow up. So the issue is degrading state services plus a shift to property taxes. Away from state funding to property taxes, and that's
and
what
also, yeah, I'm sorry, excuse me, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't mean to interrupt you. The other part of that is that a lot of places are being driven out of business, and then those lands that are being enjoyed by many, many people are given over to private development, and the lakefronts are closing in with private property and not being opened up to the public for use, which is also a bad direction, I think, for the state to be going in.
Oh,
Chairman. Thank you, Chair Osmond. And that is true. What's happening is the value of the real estate all over the district that I represent, including Cove Point, is escalating so rapidly that the value of the taxes are going up so high that it no longer makes economic sense to run the resort as a resort, because they can't generate enough income from the people that come up to stay in the resort. So the resort operator looks at it, and I'll give you an example in my community of Crane Lake. A small resort with 15 cabins just sold, and now the developer paid millions of dollars for the property and bulldozed everything and is now doing a planned unit redevelopment, and I think that's what you're referring to. And so just in a very small area around Voyageurs Park specifically, there were 60 resorts 10 years ago. Just in 1 year, five of them went through this process. Three at Captogama, one at Ash River, one at Crane Lake, where the resorts could no longer sustain themselves, so they sold to a private developer, retired on the millions of dollars that they received in payment, and now we lost a resort. And that goes to the Minnesota Congress of Resorts, will tell you that some years ago there were 4,000 mom-and-pop resorts in Minnesota, and today there are somewhere in the vicinity of 900 in just a 10-year period. So this is a phenomenon that's happening all over the place, and then it's further accentuated by the fact that we reduce services at state parks. People aren't as attracted to come because they don't get the experience that they're expecting, and so it's kind of a vicious circle that we're in right now. That's kind of my thought on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you talked about trails wearing out and needing to be updated and widened and so on. A lot of our recreational trails, first of all, come from funds that the users are paying through licenses or gas tax, etc. I just would like a reaction to the idea of a sticker on bikes. Has it been discussed, and what would be your thoughts on it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, yes, it has been discussed. Last summer we were in discussions with Trails and Waterways Division on that point. And it's something we have talked about, I think our members have talked about off and on for a number of years. As a part of the process, the department did a survey to determine the level of public support. That's the criteria that the department uses when looking at additional fees, like cross-country ski is coming forward as a horse fee. The survey results, I believe, were 39% opposed. And with that level of opposition from the general public, it wasn't pursued. But that is something that has been talked about off and on for a number of years. There's with that level of just general public opposition, we haven't pursued it at this time, but it's something that we have certainly talked about.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is for Mr. Olson. You gave some information about the number of North Dakotans, sort of the number of Canadians visiting some parks in a certain part of the state. I live on the western border of the state, and I have to think about it. It takes me just as long to get to Grand Portage or Voyageurs. You know, I can go, and I've done it. I mean, I go to Badlands National Park, or go out to the Black Hills, or if you're in the northern part of the state, you can go out to Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Do you have information on the number of people leaving Minnesota parks, going to other parks in the five-state, seven-state area, such that other parks and trails councils in other states might share their information with you, given the service cuts that you've outlined?
Chair, representatives, no, I don't. It's all anecdotal. Mm-hmm. But what I get are the phone calls like you get, or I bump into people, and you do bump into a number of families that say, hey, 2 years in a row now, there's no naturalists at this park. That's part of our family's program. We're going to look elsewhere. We're going to go to Custer State Park that's got the mountain, that's got in South Dakota. before we're going to go somewhere else, or we'll go to a national park this year rather than our traditional at Cicada Lake, for instance, somebody bumped into there. And I think my world, according to Jeff Olson, I think it's a little bit different than simply taking two steps back, hunker down for a couple years, then everybody comes back when you bring back the services. And why I say that, it's more critical than two steps back, because when you get outside these concentric circles of visitors, sure, the hardcore is going to be there, maybe the second ring of circles, but when you get out to the other visitors that make up that 8 million, excluding the 15 to 20% from out of state, when they have 2 years, they'll come back that second year, but maybe they won't come back third year. But my point is, there's so many other choices for families. And it may not be all exactly like state parks, but there's a lot of county parks. As I point out, the Hennepin County, they have six parks that have campgrounds. And there are parks that are 5,000 acres, 3,000 acres. There's all sorts of private things. There's all sorts of things that might be close to that marketing and that liveliness and program activities that families are looking for, that they're going to go off to those places. So it's more critical than just simply saying, okay, let's hunker down for a couple years. We'll endure the cutbacks. We'll get down to 6 million or so in visitors, and then we'll all come back, because they're going to be taking all these other choices that are out there and are providing all these guest services of being visitor centers that are open, people that greet them, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think you could easily go with a few adjustments and without much extra funding, but just providing things from that 8 million maybe to 10 or 12 million visitors and have it be more of a revenue source. But to answer your question, no, it's anecdotal, but you just run into so many stories, especially this last two summers.
Thank you. No follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, member, maybe you can help me out with the why we haven't gone after the bikers. I mean, what's our history? It seems like a real revenue source. And just the other day we had the snowmobilers once again volunteering almost to pay more, their own testimony with a sticker. And just got an untapped resource. I'm not bashful at all about proposing legislation that would require a sticker on the somewhere on a bike, and for them to get completely off the hook for paying for our trail system. I mean, if they've got enough gumption to complain about the trails being closed or not maintained, they should surely be willing to pay. And I wouldn't pay a lot of attention to a survey that somebody did or didn't want to pay a fee. If I got asked, a survey was sent to me, if I wanted to pay anything extra, certainly I would probably say no, but I would probably be the first to whine about the service not being there too. But at any rate, that's something I'd be really interested in checking out. And could you, if you don't have it today, could you furnish me with information what the other states do as far as bikes, the surrounding states, or those states that are popular with bike trails, and
Mr.
as far
Chairman,
as
yes,
extricating a fee?
Yep, can do that point.
To that point, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chair Osman. I've supported the expenditure, particularly of bonding for bike trails, ever since I've been in the legislature. But it is a really sticking, it is a real thorn in the side of ATVers and snowmobilers and people like that, that, you know, they're paying their own so-called way by paying, and now we've just, as Representative Corney suggests, proposing to raise another $5-6 million to help continue to fund that. I would also like to see some direction that you are suggesting, Representative Cornish, along those lines. And I would be wondering from you folks, if there were extra money that came from a registration or bike sticker or trail pass or whatever that is, what would you do with it? What would be your first attack on the bike trail system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I think it would go into the trail system that is out there. As Mr. Fierro testified, we have a number of state trails that are authorized but not yet completed. And if you look at this year's bonding bill, what's being discussed, there's potentially an additional 50 to 100 miles of trails going online there. So we would envision any additional revenues would go towards some of those new trails, as well as ongoing maintenance, the sweeping, the patching, those kinds of things. So back into the communities that have trails, the trail planners, and the maintenance.
It sounded to me from the testimony that when it comes to trails, we need to start thinking about lane miles, not just miles. And we're getting them wider and wider, so we'll be in the same argument we are with regard to highways. Let's see. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have another testifier, Allison Wolf. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Allison Wolf with the Nature Conservancy, representing the 24,000 members of PNC in Minnesota. Good to be here to talk about the Nature Conservancy and its strong support for conservation funding. We'd like to applaud this committee for its support over the years for conservation, and in particular, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your support, particularly of wetland protection funding. I know that that's been a special interest of yours over the years. Our state director has the following words posted in his office. Despite all our accomplishments, we owe our existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. At the Nature Conservancy, our mission is to protect those lands and those waters, the habitat that animals and plants need to survive, that we all need to survive. In its presentation to you last week, DNR's Ecological Services Division highlighted the following trends. Increasing loss of native ecosystems, including grasslands, lakeshore, stream habitats, and rare ecological communities. Increasing threats by non-native invasive species. Increasing public concern for non-game wildlife. Rapidly growing citizen demand for nature observation experiences. You also heard how difficult it is to meet these needs with limited resources. As a percentage of general fund spending, conservation budgets are now at the lowest level in 30 years. You have a handout, this pretty green and blue thing that goes over some of the functions of the Ecological Services Division, which you may want to find in your pile of paper there. I am here today to strongly encourage you to support the lean budget proposed by the governor for conservation. First of all, the Nature Conservancy is pleased to see the DNR put conservation first. When the governor asked agencies to identify the priority that they would use in divvying up general fund expenditures, the DNR decided that it would put conservation first. I'd like to highlight some areas of the DNR budget that we feel are particularly important to conservation. First of all, the County Biological Survey. Most of you are familiar with this. It's the survey of counties that identifies the location of rare plants and animals that remain in our state. The DNR is committed to complete county biological surveys by the year 2021, and we applaud the DNR's commitment to do that. Increasingly, local land use folks are interested in this data, and it's being requested more and more frequently from the DNR. To complete the surveys in all Minnesota counties, however, steady funding must be available. This year, the LCMR recommended $1 million for this work, and we fully support that recommendation. That funding will allow surveys to take place in the southwestern part of our state. You may have heard discussion during the DNR testimony about prairie wetland complexes and monitoring. This is an initiative that the DNR is undertaking. We're very excited about this prairie wetland complexes initiative. It will provide money to restore wetlands and also to monitor compliance with the state's no net loss wetland commitment. The Nature Conservancy and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will be partnering in this effort with the DNR. There's considerable interest in wetland habitat. You may realize and be aware of the April 2nd rally that's planned focusing on ducks, wetlands, and clean water. In fact, many blame recent low duck harvests on diminishing wetlands and a lack of clean water resources. Loss of habitat, especially wetland habitat, can't be fixed once it occurs. It's nearly impossible to turn a strip mall back into a healthy wetland, and even more difficult to bring back the animals and birds that were there. So we believe it's critical to take action now to protect prairie wetland complexes. One of the stumbling blocks in figuring out whether we're meeting the no net loss commitment has been just monitoring wetlands, where they are, how to identify where they are and where we're losing them. This is the monitoring piece. of the DNR's Prairie Wetlands Complex Initiative. They actually are doing some very interesting, innovative satellite techniques, and they're developing new high-tech ways to monitor wetlands across the state, basically from above, so that they can get accurate data on where the wetlands are. The Nature Conservancy scientists are participating with DNR in doing a comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy. This is a federal study of rare and declining species that's mandated in order for the state to continue to get federal wildlife grants. These scientists are working to identify animals that are rare, declining, or vulnerable in Minnesota. And this updated science will improve ecological planning as well as allow us to continue to be eligible for those federal grants. The DNR budget decided to go with the recommendation of the Game and Fish Fund Budgetary Oversight Committee. That committee recommended using an accumulated Game and Fish Fund balance spread among various divisions at DNR to maintain services and programs that would go to fish and wildlife, ecological services, enforcement, lands and minerals, and operations. And unless this is done, reduced services will result at the department in a number of programs. We do support that recommendation, but we would like to call attention to the fact that those accumulated fund balances will not be available for the 08-09 biennium. And so there is a need to look forward in terms of supporting those programs and services in the future biennia, because those funds will only last for this coming one. We're lucky in Minnesota, as we have a lot to protect. Our state has abundant lands, waters, and wildlife, and a strong tradition of investing to protect those. I know all of you have spent time in the country over the years. You probably don't see as many leopard frogs, turtles, meadowlarks as you used to. That's simply the result of diminishing healthy habitat. Nature doesn't divide this habitat into game habitat and non-game habitat, and neither does the Nature Conservancy. All plants and animals require healthy habitat. We'd like to ask that you support a budget that allows continued protection of Minnesota's finite natural resources. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. That completes my comments.
Any questions? Representative Guinea.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Wolf. At the beginning of your testimony, you gave us a statistic about 30 years, and I just missed it as you were speaking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, you can get additional information on this in the League of Conservation Voters review of the budget that most of you have gotten, I believe. Conservation budgets as a whole are at the lowest level in 30 years in terms of general fund spending. And if you have mislaid your copy of that report, we'd be happy to get that to you, because it goes into considerable detail about trends in funding for conservation over recent years.
By the low, are you talking about the percentage or are you talking about the actual dollars?
As a percentage of general fund spending, I think, is the figure, yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, what I'd like to do now is to discuss as to how we'll proceed from here with regard to putting together our budget proposal. And what I'd like to do or suggest is that we'll start gathering information and explanations of the portions of the budget, and just kind of and maybe do some of this around in a workshop type of style rather than committee process. We need to use our committee time for the bills and things that are coming in, the hearing processes. We may, I think we'd find benefit of maybe gathering at other times and just to be in the public format, but we wouldn't need to have minutes and taking have tapes and all that, so we don't have to have a page with us and all that sort of thing. So we can kind of let them go off and do their things. But we could take some time maybe and just kind of delve into the questions that you need to get a little more background and go through this budget. To me, this the way that's been laid out this year is extremely confusing. And I believe Mr. Reinholz has been working to try and get it to where it would be easier for us to understand. And so some of those materials, I think, are available now. And so I'd like to start today by just turning over to Mr. Reinholz and having him explain some of the materials that we'll present to you. And then, unless there's objection, I think we'll try to find some times when we can just start to come together and just have kind of a little workshop, casual communications type process, so we can get more familiar with the details of this budget and some of the options that are out there. It would not be those, because of the open meeting laws, we want to do it all out in the public, but when we don't have the recordings and all that sort of thing, there will not be any decisions made or any type of actions taken, so members do not need to be there. There's no roll calls or anything like that, but there'd just be kind of an opportunity for us to delve into this budget book a little bit deeper and do it together as much as possible. So that's how I intend to try and proceed the next few weeks. And Mr. Reinholz, if you'd like to bring us up to speed as to with regard to the materials and that you have and how they can be used.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. You should have been distributed in your packet the spreadsheet that you've probably seen before and probably glazed over when you see it before, but I just did want to go over this briefly. Now that the governor released his supplemental recs last Friday and the details yesterday, so I was able to update the spreadsheet to include now what hopefully will be the governor's final request for this legislature. Every once in a while there's a last minute request, but I believe the spreadsheet here now probably does reflect his final request. So if you just pull this out and I'll briefly describe to you what I'm showing on here. This is the spreadsheet that, quite frankly, I use primarily to track the funding, and myself and House Research uses to insert numbers into the bill and to send along the fiscal note that we have to send with the bill as it goes through Ways and Means to certify the amount of spending that the committee's approved. Let me just walk through it, not in detail, but just so you understand the structure here. The first page is really, it's a general fund by agency summary. This is only reflecting general fund dollars. The committee, as you know, will eventually have a target assigned to it in total general fund spending. This is what will be displaying how we relate to that target when the committee makes final action. What I'm showing in the columns across, there's really three groupings. One is called the current spending. That's the fiscal year that we're biennium that we're currently in, fiscal year 2004 and 2005. You see a summary by the agencies. That is the current general fund spending. That is really the spending that was approved 2 years ago by this committee for the environment and ag agencies, and along with the ag finance committee for this area. The middle three columns are titled the base request. You recall the base is the starting point in the budget document for most decisions. It's essentially the current level of spending with some adjustments made. The primary adjustments, there were 2 years ago, there were items that the legislature passed funding on that said this are one-time only funds. Those are reduced out then of the current appropriations to arrive at what we have is called a base level for each agency. Sometimes you'll hear same level of effort. That is different than when you say base request. That's only dollars. It's not talking about the activity they're doing. It's talking about the number of dollars that the agency has. So base does not include it really doesn't include is any taking into consideration the cost of inflation in any way. The last three columns are titled the governor's request over here, and what I've laid out there at the top is what the governor is requesting after his change items for the agencies. Beginning on lines 23 through 39, what those are doing is accounting for revenue changes. That's why they're only in the governor's request. There's no revenue changes in current or base. It's only in the governor's request where he has initiatives that change revenues revenues are taken into account into the target. If revenues go up or down, those are factored in along with expenditures. So what you see really laid out here, and this particularly important, is the last three columns. Is the governor requests that there be on line 21, you'd see way over on the far right column, a total of $369,756,000 worth of general fund spending in the agencies that come under the review of this committee. Factoring in revenue changes that the governor has, you see what we have really is a net general effect of $399,000. It's larger than the spending because the governor's net changes on revenue are minus to the general fund. There's a total revenue changes of losing $29 million to the general fund. So in netting that out, actually the net effect would be a larger amount than the actual spending. You don't need to keep track of that too much. I keep track of that, and there's a little spot where it ends up saying zero. We're on target, hopefully.
Representative McGee?
Can you help me out here? It would be helpful to know when you were looking at the base request, that's without inflation. We heard from DNR, for example, that they have 4% inflation in reality, so we're getting cut. What that base request would be if it had inflation, is that something you could, it may not be 4% across the board, but if you could give us some clues, that would be helpful. And then I'm looking at comparing that base request with the general fund money, including the revenue changes. And is that a reasonable, fair comparison?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rugini, for some purposes, yes, that is a comparison. That will be the number that you can net out to. The revenue things typically only last the one biennium, so there's depending on what comparison you're making, in some cases the expenditure. As far as talking about the net ability of agencies to deliver programs, I think you would concentrate on expenditures. When you're talking in terms of pure financial, then it would be accurate to go down to that bottom number that includes revenue. Mr. Chairman, Representative Guinness, as far as the inflationary effects, I don't think 4% is an accurate number for inflation. I'm not. Inflation in fiscal year 05, I believe, is estimated to be somewhere less than between 2 and 3% actually inflation is. The primary, the largest expenditure in most agencies, quite frankly, is salaries, with the exception of the ethanol payments and some of the DNR local government, the PIL payments and the Indian tribe payments. If you took those out, the primary expenditure is salaries. Taking those out and then using inflation, I think it would be somewhere between 2 and 3% would probably be the more accurate number to use. So you could put that on the total of the base and see what they really would need to have to stay up with inflation.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Absolutely.
Ms. Reinholz, I want the fairest number you can come up with, and if that's the way you would track it as fair, that would be just fine with me.
Mr.
To come up with what a number plus inflation would be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, I can do that. I was kind of waiting also to see what the DNR provides in response to the questions they were given on that, and then I would be happy to work off of that number.
That would be fine, too. That's only for DNR, but...
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
If I go back to this, and just to give you a little more, and I'm just going to do it quickly because I got another one I want to talk to. If you turn to the second page, what this is showing is the budget summary, all funds. First page was just general fund. This one now is showing all the funds. And it is, of course, a little different picture. You can see the total spending, if you look on line 46 and go across, the total current spending is $1.1 billion when the general fund was $405 million. So you can see a more than 50% is non-general fund, and this is listed out not by agencies but by the various funds. And you can see then that the base is just over $1 billion, $1,092,000,000, and the governor's rec over here is $1,106,000,000. So it's a different story than you see in the general fund. In the general fund, the governor's rec was lower than both current and the base request, but when you include all funds, you see that the governor's rec is actually larger than the base request. And that reflects the fact that several of the items the governor is requesting reduce general fund money, but also increase non-general fund money spending, the largest single item being in the OEA. That was previously general fund dollars, and the governor is recommending that the revenue from the solid waste fees no longer go to the general fund and have an appropriation from the general fund, but now go to the environmental fund and have an appropriation. So it looks like a reduction in general fund dollars, and it is, but that is then made up by an increase in environmental fund dollars. This is just another summary page that I use and we use when the bill goes through to show people what the effect of decisions made by the committee are. When you move on to page 3, it starts to be the details by agency. And this is both something that I use for the tracking and also can be useful for the committee in making decisions. And this is divided into pages 3 through, I believe, 29. 3 through 20, actually 31 now, are the details by agency divided into two pieces because we're required by House rules to have an environment bill and an ag bill. So the first, I believe, I'm looking fast, 20 pages, I believe, are the environmental portion of the bill. It looks like the first 23, actually. And the ag bill begins on, the ag portion begins on page 24. And I'm not going to go through this, but I'll just go through the structure once again. I've done this previously, but I want to make sure you understand the structure. So if you look at page 3, I'll just use this as an example. This is some of the details on the Pollution Control Agency on line 4 there, the agencies listed. It then is broken into smaller pieces within the agency, and the first is based on program structure. Program, once again, remember, is a budgetary term besides just a term in your mind. It is a larger number in most cases than you would think of as when people use program. The departments divide their budget into program structures. In the PCA, there's the water program, the air program, the land program, the multimedia, and the administrative. So they have those large groupings. What's showing here on line 6, this is the waters program. Line 7 through 14 are the base amounts. This is a piece that would then roll up and correspond to that base amount I was talking about as being what basically left the current spending with adjustments. And you'll see here that in this instance on line 14 over under the governor's rec, way over on column 0, the total base for the waters program is $63,021,000. And then what and probably of most importance to the committee are the change items being requested within this program. And there's two in this program. That's on line 17 and line 19. And what this shows here is that on line 17, there's a general fund reduction being proposed by the governor in the waters program of $5,100,000 over the 2 years of the biennium, way over on column 0. But on line 19, there is titled General Fund Reduction because that was the title of the governor's change item, and it was related to the item on line 17, and this is where I said there's sort of backfilling. The governor's change item cut $5 million out of $5,100,000 from general fund, but is asking for an increase of $23,406,000 from the environmental fund. If you recall during their testimony, there was more than just a shifting of funding here. They also were asking for the gap. They called it the gap funding in waters. That's included in there out of the environmental fund. So there's two change items. And if you go down to the bottom line number for this division, which is on row 32, way over on column 0, you'll see that the governor's request now for this division is $81,327,000, which is considerably above the base request of $63 million. What the committee typically focuses on is the change items. The committee like that change item? Yes or no? Are they going to approve it? That's typically the steps that are taken. The rest of this is this, all those pages through the agencies is the same structure. It goes program by program. Every change item that the governor has submitted is in his columns M, N, and O. The committee would be considering those along with all the bills that come before the committee. The only other thing that I wanted to mention on here is beginning on page 32. Are the LCMR recommendations that the committee will be considering approving, disapproving, or changing. And these are just as they were presented to the committee, Representative Tinglestead's bill bringing the LCMR recommendations forward. This lays out, and I use this to map out the decisions made by the committee. It can be useful for the committee to see what decisions they're being asked. I usually then try to simplify that decision making, and now I'll ask you to turn to the one page sheet I handed, the page handed out during committee. I guess what I said, I try to make the decision making. This one is more to be used for decision making by the committee. What this is general fund only, and you'll notice it has that same structure on the lines from 3 through 22. I've taken away the current because that's just sort of history now. What I've indicated is the base request and the governor's request. Those numbers would correspond to the exact same numbers that are on page 1 of the large spreadsheet. Start out, here's the base request for the agency. But what I've done here, and this is just general fund only, on lines 24 through lines 58, I've taken out of the big spreadsheet all of the governor's change item requests and listed them there. So you see that what I've done then is try to take this 40-page spreadsheet and on one page lay out for you, rather simply, here's the request the governor has made in general fund for you to make decisions on. They're listed by agency. And then the name that the governor used on his change item submittal. As you can see, there's a very short, small list in the general fund. I think it's 18 items, and several of them are related, so they're really less than 18 decisions on the governor's request to the general fund. In PCA, it's the reduction that's requested in general fund. In OEA, it's the switching, on lines 27, it's the switching, reducing general fund. Since this is general fund, it doesn't show it, but there is a corresponding increase in an environmental fund in the budget. In DNR, it's the general fund reductions that they presented. The minerals management account is the switching of funding minerals out of really the general fund to a suspense account similar to what we heard today in forestry that would take the dollars out of the funds that have revenue coming that have been presented to us both in bill form and by the department. Line 33 is the road easement application fee. That was the department testified that on. That was in the minerals division. In the waters division, they had some increased spending that they were asking for, and that was presented to us. Trust land management cost shifts. This is the one that was Representative Blainsville today that was before us, the $7 million moving it from the general fund to a suspense fund. The water permit fee increase was a small $10,000 in each year related to the Xcel Energy plant, and the Waters Division of DNR presented that. 37 is the PILT reduction that was in the governor's bill. 33 is debt service on the plains is being eliminated because they're paid for. 41 is that moving into the Minnesota Conservation Corps is the governor's rec to reduce general funding there. 43 is Bowser. There are two recommendations. The governor has a general fund reduction in each year of $300,000 in admin, and the Area 2 reduction, that's a grant they're recommending be reduced. Agriculture has four items. If you recall, they testified on two of these were they have testified on the new building lease cost, that is increased general fund cost for the new building they're moving into. 49 was the apiary fee increase spending that they had presented. 50 and 51 are two items that came out in the governor's supplemental budget Friday, and the committee, I believe we will be scheduling some testimony from the department on the livestock siting technical assistance initiative and the livestock odor and emissions research. Those are recommended now to the governor at those amounts. And in the Board of Animal Health, a new building lease cost is an increase recommended because their rent is going up at their new building. This now shows the total of the changes. The governor's on line 56, the governor shows his total of recommended changes is a reduction of $46,437,000 in general fund spending over the 06 and 07. And then if you move down on line 62 through 78, it's those same revenue items, general fund revenue items that the governor's recommending, which are also decision items for the committee. And the bottom is just summaries. So this really takes the entire recommendations of the governor in the general fund area and puts it on one page for you to review. We're running out of time, but I had some time I wanted to present that to you.
Representative Cornish?
Just one quick explanation again in layman's terms here. Usually when we see an addition to the budget, it's not in parentheses. That means a reduction, like a road easement application fee, we show parentheses, even though we're collecting money for that. And then the apiary fee increase, it doesn't show. What's the reason for parentheses in one and not the other?
If they're, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, if they're in parentheses, that's a reduction. And what's going on in that road easement fee is they're currently paying those expenditures out of the general fund. If you go into the governor's recommendation, there's a fee collected, and it's not in the general fund, and then it will show up there as a plus. So anything in a negative, anything in parentheses is a negative, so it's a reduction in expenditures.
Gotcha.
We have the new pages or the papers that can be inserted in your books that would reflect to the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. They are available for you if you want to take them and put them in your own book, or if you leave your book here, then we'll have our staff insert those new pages in there. So it's that's what you really need to be looking at. Taking the book, looking at the change items. Here's the documents that can kind of help you pick out the different programs. And when we get into our study groups or working sessions, and if any programs that you want to know more information about, bring that to our attention. We'll try to line them up so we're kind of going by departments. So we'll try to have some people here from the departments that can give us some background information as we're kind of discussing the different programs. Keep in mind that the governor's programs are more detailed with regard to activities when they want when there's actually a change item, but when the all their different programs are listed on these sheets, and as you go through those different programs, you want to know more about them, and you may or may not agree with the amount of dollars that are going to those existing programs. Just because there's no change doesn't mean they're not on the table. Everything's kind of on the table for discussion, so we can see as to what we want to do or what might want to move around for the position that this committee would like to take on the proposals. What I'm hoping to do is in the working sessions for us to have some discussion of it so to kind of get a flavor for where people are coming from, the items that you're concerned with. If there's something we need to have formal testimony on, we'll then that comes out of those committees, we'll line that up. So that's then on the record. Then I intend to put together a chair's recommendation to the committee, and then we'll kind of work off the chair's recommendation. But we'd like to have your input before we get that far. So that's the reason for the working sessions as well as committee process between now and when we actually get to, after Easter somewhere, and try to get all this brought together into a workable format. Any questions that members have at this point? I want to thank Mr. Reinholz for getting this put together so quickly and appropriately. I think that this will be very helpful as you walk through. Helps keep track, because that book is mind-boggling to me, and it's easier for me to work off the spreadsheets. Any other questions? Okay, we are adjourned.